Heyo friends, one real quick thing to note. At the time of recording this episode, Alyssa's book, Unapologetic Eating, was set to release on February 9th. You will hear us reference that repeatedly. Unfortunately, due to a major snowstorm, they had to push the launch back to February 16th. So if you are listening on this day that this episode comes out, please go pre-order her book. And if you're listening to it later on, please go buy her book. Now, let's get to it. Heyo, and welcome to another week of Steady She Grows. Today I have Alyssa Rumsey on the show. She is a registered dietitian, nutrition therapist, certified intuitive eating counselor, and the author of Unapologetic Eating, Make Peace with Food, and Transform Your Life. Alyssa is passionate about advocating for women to reclaim the space to eat and live unapologetically. She is the founder of Alyssa Rumsey Nutrition and Wellness, which is a weight-inclusive nutrition practice that offers virtual counseling and online programs to help people liberate themselves from dieting, cultivate a peaceful relationship with food and their bodies, and live more authentic, connected lives. She calls New York City home and spends her free time exploring the city food scene and searching for patches of green space to sunbathe in. Y'all, so we kick off today's episode talking about what intuitive eating is and how she got into this space in the nutrition and diet world. And then we really spend the bulk of the episode diving into what it took to create this book, how she got her publishing deal, all the various stages of creation, and what she's doing now that the book launched today to really get it out into the world and into people's hands. So whether you're here for unapologetic eating, or maybe you've got a book in your brain that you're hoping to take out into the world, this is absolutely the episode for you. Stick around. Real quick, before we run that intro music, if you are feeling stuck, stalled, or stymied with any project in your business, with your business as a whole, and you need some outside insight to get things rolling again, check out my Power Hour sessions. That's just what it sounds like. You and me for 1 hour, we're going to power through, figure out what's going on, figure out your best next steps, and you have access to me for another week following that call so that we know we've got you on the right path and that we've got the kinks worked out of the problem. Whatever's got you stuck in your business, let's tackle it. You can learn more at caseyjordan.com/powerhour. And now, to that intro reel. Welcome to Steady She Grows. I'm Casey Jordan, and this is the podcast that is dedicated to giving you an honest look at the realities of being a solo entrepreneur. My guess is that you want to grow a sustainable and feel-good business without burnout and overwhelm. I have a passion for creating clarity out of the chaos that is building a business without a giant budget, without a team of people to manage, and in the hours you choose to work. We're talking about the realities of what it takes to be a solopreneur, both logistically and emotionally. And now to today's episode. Welcome to the show today, Alyssa Rumsey. This is a big day for you, the day that this episode is airing, February 9th. Your book is launching, which is part of why we're here to talk.
Yeah. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, after the long, long writing process, it's a little surreal that this day is actually here.
Right. Exactly. So let's back up. Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, how you get paid.
Sure. So my name is Alyssa Rumsey, and I am a registered dietitian, and I really more prefer the title nutrition therapist at this point, given the work that I do. So I have a weight inclusive virtual private practice where I help people, mainly women, but help people divest from diet culture and from this idea that your weight and your body size has to be, you know, this look a certain way. And so really helping people step out of these kind of boxes that society has built for us and just connect more to their own body. So I practice using the intuitive eating framework and the health at every size framework, and really just helping people get back in their bodies, using food kind of as the entry point for that, to have a more peaceful relationship with food and their bodies and just feel more grounded in themselves. So yeah, my one-on-one client work is the main backbone of the business. I also have a team, and we do periodically run group programs as well, which I'm hoping to do more of in the coming year or two. And then yeah, now have the kind of the book as another way for my you know, my services and kind of this process. One-on-one coaching obviously can be expensive and isn't super accessible for everybody. So I see the book also as kind of a way to build more accessibility into my work.
I love that. I also have really enjoyed like coaches that I've worked with reading their book beforehand because you hear their voice so much. And it's like, I feel like I know them before I even give them that large sum of money. So it's like, even if I can't afford it, I might start with the book, just make sure we're a good fit before we even dive in. Very cool. So when you, I think this is so important. Like I mentioned before I hit record, I have a decade experience in health and fitness, nutrition coaching. And it is now that I'm fully out of that industry and looking at kind of this intuitive eating movement and like dealing with my own body stuff. Like I have definitely this last year, I think a combination of COVID, my husband's health, hormones, like jumped 20 pounds and like, I'm not going to panic this time. You know? And it's like, so it's such an important conversation. I'm curious, how long have you been in nutrition and, or like, did you start in this frame? Like take us to the evolution kind of leading up to where we're at now.
Sure. So I've been a dietitian for over 12 years. And then before that, spent 5 years training to be a dietitian and was very much invested in the nutrition field. So it's been, you know, close to 20 years since my interest in nutrition kind of came about. And no, I was not always practicing from this standpoint. My interest in nutrition actually began when I was in high school, and it came from a disordered place. My interest in it started when I hit puberty and also simultaneously stopped playing basketball, which I had played for most of my life up until that point. And predictably, because in puberty, you gain weight, but you know, no one told me that at that point. And I started gaining weight and then my body was changing and I just like kind of panicked and started dieting. And then kind of, you know, through like some of my classes was learning more about nutrition. And I was like, oh, this is super fascinating. And I just found nutrition fascinating, but I was also coming from a place of like trying to control my body and my weight and trying to make my body look a certain way. And then, you know, while it's starting to slowly shift the training, like the health professional training or nutrition professional training specifically, it's still, and it certainly was then, very weight centric, meaning, you know, weight and weight loss and weight quote management were sort of the pillars of what we were being taught to do. No matter kind of what someone was coming through the door with, that was something that you evaluated people on and evaluated specifically their health just based on their weight, which I now know is not at all a good indication of health, but that was my training. And then that's how I practiced for years, but I also ended up taking a job. My first job was in a hospital in the intensive care unit. So I was saying this to someone recently, I feel like that first job, which I worked at for over 6 years, kind of saved me in a little bit with certain ways because I wasn't doing weight loss coaching or stuff like that, that I probably would have done, right, if I wasn't working in a hospital. And then I did start my own business about 6 years ago and was doing weight loss coaching and then stumbled upon intuitive eating and kind of through this process, like I had kind of naturally gone through this process myself in my 20s, not really intentionally. And I was also sort of seeing kind of what clients of mine were struggling with and then learned about intuitive eating and more about weight science. And it was just like, oh, wait, this makes so much sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I agree. I think the thing of starting in the ICU had to have totally changed the trajectory of how this all played out, because that is a very different type of eating, of nutrition, yeah, of way of looking at food. And this is one where it just recently I have some chronic pain problems. And so the VA here where I'm at now has kind of, they have a integrated pain program. And so they had a whole anti-inflammatory diet group. And it was so interesting for me to sit through that class because none of it was new about the science of nutrition. This is stuff I'd been teaching for 10 years with weight loss in mind for my people at the gym that I worked at. And like, but we're now talking about it in terms of inflammation and pain. And I was like, oh yeah, food does so much more than just make us fatter or skinnier or healthier or less healthy. I was like, it was just this kind of light bulb moment that like, I don't know, kind of let some garbage go with, and it was just like, yeah, so good.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's such a difference between using food and, you know, someone's relationship to food when the primary focus, even if there's some other things, like even if health is mixed in there too, but still there's usually this underlying, like, I want to be smaller, or my body needs to be smaller, or there's something wrong with my body. I need to make it smaller. I need to change it in some way, you know, approaching food that way versus approaching it from, okay, I am taking care of my body. I'm respecting my body. I'm, you know, finding kind of the gray area where it's not black and white, where I'm kind of letting my body be and just figuring out what it needs and trying to take care of it the best I can. And sometimes the outcome of what we eat or don't eat ends up being the same, but that intention just completely changes the energy around food and goes from, you know, what I hear a lot for most people I work with is there's like so much like guilt and shame wrapped up around their food choices. They're either quote like on the wagon or off the wagon. It's very like all or nothing. And like a ton of like inner critic, just like beating themselves up when they quote like fall off the wagon. And on the other side of it, you know, with this different intention, again, the food choices might be similar, but there's none of that. It's just like, okay, eating and then moving on and not being stuck in this like, oh, good or bad, or oh, should or shouldn't, and just like being able to trust. It's, yeah, so life-changing.
Yeah, it's funny because when I first started hearing about intuitive eating, it didn't make sense at that level. It was kind of like, I was so ingrained that food had moral values and was kind of teaching and living from that aspect. And like, so people talked about it, it was like, you just eat and then move on. And it was like, but how? Because if I eat 6 donuts, I'm going to feel bad about it. And now it's like, oh, I ate 6 donuts and I'm literally sick to my stomach from the quantity of sugar I just consumed, but I don't feel guilty about it. It does not make me less of a person. All of a sudden, yeah, like that realization is such a big one. And the whole conversation about size, I'm on TikTok more than I care to admit, and some of my favorite content creators right now are having that conversation about especially women and big bodies. Mm-hmm. And you just go through their comment section and it's just horrific the things they say to them, and people are saying, well, I'm just watching out for your health. My dudes, like, I used to live off of a pack of cigarettes, 2 Rockstar energy drinks and a bologna sandwich every day. And I was skinny, so nobody said crap to me about it. Like, I guarantee you there are large people who are much healthier than I was at that weight. And like, it's now like one of those, like, I totally will get in fights in comment sections now. Like, come at me.
Yeah, no, the fat phobia is so real. And I think in our culture, our society, these anti-fat beliefs are just so baked in. I mean, all of us have this implicit bias against fat bodies and against bigger bodies and, you know, quote unquote preference for thinner bodies. But this isn't this, like, I always say, like, you didn't pop out of the womb thinking that like fat bodies were bad and thin bodies were good. Like, this was something that was taught to you. And I think, you know, your example right there is such a good example of how it's not about the health. It's about, you know, fat phobia. And yeah, I include, you know, a bunch of examples of that in my book because I am, you know, in a straight size body. I have a lot of body privilege. I have thin privilege. And yeah, like, I can talk about these things and get all this praise and be like, oh, you're so brave. This is so great. And then I have colleagues who are in larger bodies who say the same exact things and exactly what you just described. Their comment section blows up with all these people trolling and bullying them and saying they're, you know, being a bad example and, you know, promoting quote obesity and stuff like this. So yeah, I think, you know, really, I think so much of this process is about just questioning like, okay, wait, why do I think this is true? Or where did this belief come from? And just sitting with that, because everything that we think we know about food, about bodies, about weight is something we've been taught at some point, either explicitly or implicitly, and is not necessarily correct.
Exactly. And I feel like it's also still a very evolving science. The more we understand about the human body, the more we understand how, you know, different things, you know, supplements, nutrition, you know, how all that plays out. So there's also that for me after doing this, you know, it's like that being open to looking at it again from another perspective. So looking at it from the anti-inflammatory perspective, my husband had colon cancer this past summer and no longer has a colon. And turns out that has a big impact on how your body handles food. Yeah. And so it's this like ongoing discussion in our house of, you know, what can he eat? What's the impact of that food? But making sure that he's getting enough nutrition, that he's not, you know, vitamin deficient. And so there's like another whole different, like now it's a very medical based conversation in our house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having two people, like I just eat what he eats because that's more simple, which some of it isn't the best food right now, but it's what he can digest and it's what he appeals to him, you know, and it's like, it's like, this is a thing that we have to keep revisiting. Like this isn't a one and done. I learned that I need to eat this, that, and the other. Like this is as our hormones change, as we deal with disease, as we learn new science, constantly changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really this like flexibility piece of being flexible, like when new information presents itself or when you learn something new about like, oh, okay, this, you know, meal was really satisfying and filling to me and now it's really not, or like, I thought I loved this thing and now I'm not really enjoying it. And just, yeah, that flexibility as, you know, things change, like you said, as bodies change, you know, just being flexible and really once you've connected to your body and you have, you know, or gotten back to that connection, right? Because we're all born with this intuitive connection to our body, like to know, you know, babies know how much they need to eat and when they're hungry and when they're full. And then we lose that over time, we get disconnected. So once you're back kind of in your body and then more connected, then, you know, those things can just be like learning experiences over time.
Yeah, exactly. So let's switch gears. Let's dive into the book because I could talk all day about nutrition. It was one of those things. It's a subject I love. I started working in that industry and I was like, I don't love it enough to do this all day and write meal plans. I'm out. Like,
No meal plans.
Yeah. So this is like selfishly, I could pick your brain all day on this subject. But let's dive into the book. That's what I really wanted to have you here is talk about how the book came to be, especially because I feel like this is still such an emerging topic. How did you decide to go this route?
So, you know, I'd always kind of had in the back of my head, like someday I would probably want to write a book. I write, you know, professionally somewhat, and I write, you know, my own blog. And, you know, it actually came about really happenstance. This was like a year and a half ago or in 2019, intuitive eating, like when I started training in intuitive eating, I had never heard about it up until that point. And this was only like 4 or 5 years ago. And then it's really had this, I think a lot, thanks to social media, it's had this resurgence in the last couple of years, even though the concept of intuitive eating was something created by two dietitians in the mid 90s. And they've since, they're on their fourth edition of the book, but yeah, it's really come to the forefront in the last few years. So in 2019, I had a publisher actually reach out to me, and they historically published, you know, mainly diet type books and like cookbooks. But they said, like, one of their VPs had heard about intuitive eating, saw that it was kind of like on the rise. And then also, you know, like most people, like when they start to read about it, they're like, okay, wait, this makes sense of, you know, like listening to our body and things like that. And so they had found my name and they just said, have you ever wanted to write a book? And it's funny because I almost deleted the email that they sent because it like almost looked like a spammy type email. I did not think it was real. And luckily I did decide to respond and I decided to get on a call with them, but I also didn't really prep for the call because I thought it was going to be like BS. The man I spoke to said, well, like, have you ever wanted to write a book? Like, what would you want to write about? And so kind of off the cuff pitched him this idea, which really became the backbone of the book. And, you know, it's really about the work I've done both myself, but also with my clients. And just, you know, I wanted to write about how, you know, using food as the entry point to kind of this, I don't always love the term like personal growth, but just to this, like being able to connect more to yourself, to know more about like who you are and what you want out of life and be more grounded in yourself and be able to really, you know, step into your power more. And because when I first started working with clients, you know, I was really like, okay, I'm going to be working on like their relationship to food, like being able to eat and not feel guilty. And yes, that is part of what we do, but oh my gosh, it's so much more than that. And what I quickly realized is that the problem is actually not with food, and it's definitely not with the person. Like, the problem is with our society and these like underlying systems and structures that really were set in place purposefully to disconnect us from our bodies. And so really the idea behind the book was based on working with my clients, and just what I love about my client work is that it's so much more than just the food. Like, food is like the tip of the iceberg. And then when we start working together, it's like all this other stuff comes out, and they just like, oh, they can like set boundaries, you know, they can say no to things. They're just so much more grounded in like themselves and who they are, and like not apologizing for that. And so that's really what I wanted to do with this book. There's, you know, it's a growing space. There's some really amazing books in the space, definitely not as many as in the diet space, but I wanted it to be just to show people how food can be this really beautiful entry point to start, you know, learning more about yourself and like trusting yourself in all these other areas of life as well. So I pitched, you know, this couple of sentence thing, and then they're like, that sounds great. Let's do it. Yeah. So I feel very lucky with kind of how that happened. And then I was also a little, you know, because again, knowing what they had previously published, and I was like, are they gonna, you know, I'm using terms like patriarchy and white supremacy and like, you know, the introduction. And I was like, I was just waiting for like the shoe to drop and for someone to be like, you can't say that. But no, you know, I had this amazing editor who was so fantastic and just really worked with me to like keep the content what I wanted and keep my voice. And yeah, it was actually a really great experience.
That's amazing. I think that's like every wannabe author's dream, is that the publisher just calls up one day and says, hey, can I give you a deal? But because this is a thing I talk about a lot, like, this wasn't an overnight success. You are known in the industry. You are doing good work. You are out there. I always dig through people's websites and their social media before I have them on the show. And like, you're not new to this game. And so yes, it was out of the blue. It was also on the backbone of years of hard work and putting this knowledge out there. So it's hard work pays off, whether you have to write the proposal or not, like somewhere you have to do the work ahead of it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think the other thing is too, I've turned down several other book offers it's a company that does more like fee for hire, like not your standard like royalty kind of publishing agreement, which was part of the reason that I turned it down. Not the whole reason though, but yeah, just because it like didn't feel right, or wasn't the right time, or like the topic wasn't right, or I was in a constant state of learning, and I learned so much in writing this book, but yeah, I just didn't feel like it was the right time. And so I think this just came at a time where there was still some of that imposter syndrome, which I recognize not myself. That's what society has put on me. But like, there was some of that still there for sure. But yeah, it just felt more aligned. And I felt like, okay, I feel like I now do have something to say. And I'm not just like writing a book to write a book, because I really wanted to make sure that it was going to add to the space, you know, to like the non-diet space or the intuitive eating space, and not just be kind of another book that rehashed like similar things.
Right. Right. Very cool. So walk us a little bit through, now you've got the deal. Did you have to go back and kind of create any more of a pitch for them? Or did you get to just kind of dive in at that point? Like, tell us about like actual creation process.
Yeah. So again, I think this is a little bit different than from what I've heard from other colleagues of mine, you know, who do have to present sort of a more in-depth or write a few chapters. You know, I think I have a lot of my writing on the internet already. And from what my understanding was, they had dug through that and read a good deal of that already. So no, I actually did not. We went right from there to actually negotiating the contract. And I had family members who were like, you're a first-time author, like they're not gonna like really let you negotiate. And I'm like, well, I'm gonna try. And so I negotiate contracts a lot, like in my other side of the business. So I have experience with that. And so I have a lawyer friend who he sent me this like 300-page PDF just about like, because I'm very familiar with contracts, but not publishing contracts.
Right.
So he sent me this PDF that was like, he's like, I'm not a publishing lawyer, but here's what one of my colleagues said is helpful. I like, no joke, went like line by line. And I just asked for basically like whatever I could, knowing, right, this is negotiation. They're not going to say yes to everything. So I'm like, well, let me just ask for everything and see. And I got most of what I wanted, surprisingly. Like, we went back and forth on a few things. But yeah, I felt like really happy with the final result of that. And then I did end up hiring, after I had gone through that, I did hire a lawyer who specializes in book publishing to kind of help, you know, obviously with some of the last bits. So yeah, it was, we kind of went right into that process. And then, and the VP I had been most in touch with, he kept saying to me like, okay, you know, once we get this done, like, you know, we set the deadline and then you're basically on your own. He's like, this can be the really hard part, because he's like, we're here, like, if you want feedback or need feedback, but like, they weren't checking in with me. Like, I had to, you know, kind of come up with, you know, which is funny because I did not stick to this at all, but I did come up with, okay, here's the end deadline. Once I had my table of contents, like, okay, here's like my pace of like how much I have to write each day. Because yeah, they were not checking in. They were just like, okay, send us, you know, once you have this stuff. And I actually did end up with my editor sending her stuff periodically, just to get that initial feedback to make sure if there was anything like gross that I needed, you know, big that I need to change. But yeah, it was interesting. It was a lot more hands-off than I expected. So it was had to be very self-driven.
Yeah, that surprises me. That's interesting to hear, because one of the reasons I had always planned on just self-publishing the stuff that I'm working on, and having a conversation with a friend who's a little further along in her career. And I said, you know, one of the things I'm struggling with is like holding myself to deadlines. And she's like, well, if you have a publisher, they'll have deadlines for you. And I was like, oh, that's a great idea. And as we kind of looked at like some of my weaknesses, like a publisher essentially puts those things into place. But like, if there's just one big deadline at the end, I don't think I can write an entire book in one all-nighter. I think my typical style of writing goes out the window at that point.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I know people have different experiences with different publishing houses. I also know, you know, obviously for people like the like Brené Browns and people with like a huge team and are doing kind of more in-depth meetings. But yeah, I do know a lot of authors that it was mostly like, okay, we're here if you need us. And I did send my editor, I was like, here's my schedule, what do you think? And she's like, okay, that looks good. But yeah, it really, you know, on my end was more kind of self-directed, just with this like big deadline and like, okay, I got to get it by then.
That's crazy. Did you lighten your regular workload to make room for this? Or like, how did that kind of play into your day-to-day business while the book was coming together?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that was something as I was considering, you know, in negotiating my royalty rate, I, you know, could have asked for some sort of advance. But the way advances work is that if, you know, say I took like a $10,000 advance, before I'd get any royalties, the book would have had to make $10,000. And then, so you're basically have to pay it back. And then I was also, because I did not take an advance, I was able to negotiate a higher royalty rate. And, you know, for me, because I was not planning to like completely stop and like only write this book, you know, it wasn't really a feasible option. So I was like, okay, I'm still going to have money coming in. So I was able to feel comfortable not taking an advance. And yeah, you know, I think it was just like, I did cut down on clients, because I like signed the contract, had this deadline, made myself this, you know, wild spreadsheet with what I was going to like all the chapters when I was going to write them that literally did not pay attention to at all in the end. But, you know, and then, so I signed this contract and like literally a week later is when like the world shut down from COVID. So the first few months were just, you know, I like the way that I work, like I am very, very good at getting through to-do lists, like checking emails, doing these little, like doing tasks. And so just with, and I live in New York City. So the spring of 2020 in New York City was very, very difficult and just like so much anxiety. I'm like right in Manhattan. And so So yeah, I did not get much done on my book in the first few months. And I really like gravitated towards what felt comfortable and safe in my work, which was like the client work and my like day to day. And it was really hard for me to feel like I had like extra bandwidth to be like creating and producing something. But then I did end up putting some boundaries up around my time over, you know, late spring and then into the summer, which is when most of my writing took place. And I have a contractor who I was already working with, but I upscaled their hours and had them do some more of my like discovery calls for coaching. They took like all the new coaching clients for several months. And I went down, I normally do 2 days a week of clients. I went down to just one. And then for a few weeks, none. It was over the summer. So it was kind of easy because clients were also kind of like, you know, vacation and just doing different things. So I was able to get like a few weeks with nothing. So I did end up, you know, scaling back a bit that time. And just what I found too was that the way I work, if I had like a couple hour block, like I wouldn't write. Like I needed to know I had the whole day and could like sit down and just write. So once I realized that, that's when I was like, okay, I gotta start scaling things and just like literally protecting, like, okay, there's 1 day a week of calls, nothing else.
I think that's like, whatever your business is, book writing aside, I think that's such an important thing to figure out. Like for me, I cannot write more than a couple hours at a time, but I like writing when it's like, I love like 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. when the world's like dark and quiet and still, and hopefully the husband and the dogs are still in bed and it's just me in the world. Like that's my jam. Like the idea of writing all day just makes me break out in cold sweats, you know, but it's like, you have to figure out what works for you. And so, yeah, that's perfect that it was like, you knew this is my jam. I'm going to claim that space and everything else can work around it.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Did you just start at the beginning and write to the end? Like how'd that play out? We know you threw your schedule out the window.
Yeah, schedule went out the window. I think originally, yes, that was probably I'm sure that's what my schedule was like going straight through. No, I did not do that. I actually started with the second and third chapters, which were the more like research heavy chapters. One is like why diets don't work. And the second one was about like weight science and just, you know, about really the truth about like weight and health and nutrition science. And so they're very research heavy. They're also things I talk about all the time. So I was like, okay, these feel like I can sit down and do them. So I started with those two. The first chapter I actually wrote the first chapter last. I'm pretty sure it was like one of the last chapters I wrote because I, you know, started it and I just like couldn't find my rhythm. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to set that aside. And I just kept going forward. So also my table of contents changed as I would write. Cause I was like, okay, this is what this chapter is about. And then I was like, oh wow, I'm getting like way above. I had like a sort of average word count I was shooting for each like after I wrote a couple, I was like, okay, this is like, you know, they're looking to be about this much. And so I'd be writing and I'm like, oh wait, this is going to be like double. I need to split this into two chapters. So that happened a lot. I probably wrote it mostly in order, but you know, as I got more into it, depending on like when I'd get stuck, I would just like give myself permission to go work on another one. And things definitely moved around a bit as I started writing it too.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I can't remember where I heard that recently. Somebody was talking about always writing the first chapter last, because kind of a lot of times the first chapter is that like talking about what I'm going to talk about. And in something as big as a book where it's changing as you go, you don't necessarily know what you're going to talk about until you've talked about it. So being able to go back and like now tie it all together and create that cohesive kind of introduction chapter. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Cause it was basically, I was like, okay, I knew like the title stayed the same for the first chapter, but yeah, I wasn't sure like what would be in other chapters and not wanting to repeat myself. And yeah, so that was last. And then the introduction was like definitely last. Like I rewrote the introduction so many times. And that was, I turned over everything else to my editor and I was like, I'm still working on the introduction. And she was like, that's fine. I have enough to work with. Like sit with it for a bit. Yeah.
So what's the editing process like? Was it just once it was the whole book was done, she went to work or?
Yeah. So, you know, I asked her what she preferred. I did send her, I think one or two chapters at the first chapters that I wrote, I sent them to her just because I wanted to see, you know, she's like, okay, for end notes, let's do it this way. And just so we would know like our communication style within the document together. And then once I had that, and also, you know, heading one, heading two, heading three, what are we going to use and things like that. But then, yeah, she was like, just send it to me at the end. So I literally on a Friday night at like almost midnight, like my due date was like, here you go, like put it in the Dropbox. Oh. And then from there, she usually sent them back to me in batches. So I told her, I was like, I turned it in and I was like, I'm planning to take like a week or two off. Is that okay? And she was like, totally. I have plenty to work with. Just email me when you're back and I'll send you over what I have. So I took a couple weeks off, which was fantastic and much needed. And then, yeah, she would send it back in batches. And I think we definitely went through every chapter back and forth, each of us twice. And then a couple, like a third pass through for some little things as well. And yeah, just kind of the old school Word doc track changes and, you know, lots of like comments and questions. In certain chapters, there wasn't much, and others, there was a lot more. Like it definitely varied a bit.
Right. And was the first round kind of like the developmental stuff of like, clarify this and then move towards the more grammatical, like technical fixes?
Yeah, you know, she did both at once. And obviously the grammatical technical, I was like, yeah, I'm sure you're right. Like there's a couple things that I was like, wait, this looks funny. And she was like, what? And she just explained to me. She's like, well, actually, yes, this is like the whatever they, I don't even know, whatever reference they use for that. But yeah, so she put both in there at once. And then if I did have a question, I could ask about it, but it was more like, you know, she'd say, can you clarify this? Or like, the link to this research study isn't working, or like, can we reword this, or, you know, stuff like that.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. So then the book is all edited. You guys have passed it back and forth. What next?
So I actually added in an additional step that is not part of every book publishing, but I actually hired two equity consultants to read the book. And I wanted to do this. This is actually something that Kelly Deals, that's how we met, was through Kelly. Mm-hmm. Kelly Deals suggested this to me. She had a call with Kay and imposter syndrome was coming up. And I was like, really feeling my just not wanting this to be a book, like just another book written by like a thin white dietitian. And, you know, Kelly said to me, we talked about obviously like using clients that have different identities than me, but then she mentioned a sensitivity reader. And I'd actually heard that because young adult novels use them a lot. And I remember reading this like a couple years of just like, you know, if you're writing a novel from the perspective of someone else, having someone who actually has that identity, like read it to make sure that, you know, your bias isn't showing basically. And so she suggested that. And then I posted in a Facebook group of health at every size professionals that I'm part of. And I got a ton of names and I ended up hiring two people. One is a fat white woman who has been in the health at every size space for a very long time. And the other is a Black non-binary person who actually Mackenzie Mack, who has a group or a business who this is what they do equity consulting, not just for books, for everything. But yeah, so I had them read it to root out my implicit bias and to really make sure that the book was as inclusive and as anti-oppressive as possible. So, you know, this can vary. I decided to bring them on. I'd already written a good chunk of the book. So we ended up doing it where after my editor and I think after we did our first pass, actually, then it went to the equity consultants. I got their feedback. I incorporated their feedback. It went back to my editor for the second pass. And then we went from there. And then with Mackenzie, Mackenzie worked with me then, like other just things that came up, like my introduction that I was really struggling with. And, you know, I ran, cause I was basically editing, cause then I got like the designed PDF back. And now at this point, this is months later. And so we're learning all the time. So I'm already seeing like things that I wrote a few months prior. So I was like, oh, wait, I need to change this. And so yeah, just that kind of process kept going. But yeah, so I worked in this equity consultant piece as well, which was really, really, I'm so glad I did that. I learned so much.
That's a genius idea. I have never even heard of that. And so, yeah, and for any book, but especially a book, feel like yours has the potential to be very loaded
if you're not aware of, like you said, your own implicit bias. Did anything jump out that kind of blindsided you that you didn't realize was so biased that either of them caught? Watch, I'm just being
stupid. No, it's a great question. It wasn't anything major. And I think, you know, because, so also I wrote this book amidst all the Black Lives Matter uprisings that were happening in the spring and summer. And I live in an area of Manhattan where all of the protests were taking place. So that was just, again, like very, very top of mind. And I think because of that, and I was like intaking and learning so much and just reading so much, which at some point I did have to stop. Kelly was like, at some point, she's like, you have to stop. You have to just write. But I think that if I had written this a year prior, I'm sure there would have been like a lot of things that they caught. But yeah, there were definitely like smaller things, like certain words that, you know, Mackenzie pointed out, like, hey, just so you know, these can be seen as like ableist, like, and here's why. And maybe you want to put a footnote, you know, to do this. Mackenzie also gave me the suggestion of adding a glossary to the introduction because, you know, they said like, you're using a lot of terms that people might not know. And while I was like trying to introduce them, you know, and explain it with concepts. So I ended up doing the glossary, which I think really, really added a lot. And then the other thing that Mackenzie said to me that I keep thinking about this all the time now of just we have to be super explicit. Like, who do you mean when you say groups of people, which groups of people, and just being super explicit about when you're talking about groups of people or certain people, like, who do you mean? And like, name those things and name the power differential and name, you know, these different systems explicitly. So that was probably one of the biggest things. Oh, and then the other thing was, and this was something that I kept catching like all the way to the very end, and I'm sure there's ones in there that I missed, but really just, you know, part of what I wanted to do was I didn't want it to seem like, okay, like here's my thoughts and like you have to, you know, this is what you have to believe or you have to think these things. I really wanted to be open. I wanted to be educational, but also practical so people could like sit with the concepts and think about how they might, you know, work in their lives and do kind of more exploring. And so Mackenzie had pointed out some places of just, you know, you may feel like this, or sometimes people may feel like this versus like, you probably, you know, I think I had more of like, you probably have felt, or like the assumption. Mm-hmm. So just these like little language things that I think really makes the book, just more inclusive and more, you know, not kind of like just like preaching down or like assuming what people might feel.
Right. Awesome. And then, so the last kind of couple steps of the covers on the book, like as we're recording this, we're 2 weeks prior to the launch date. So like, what's been the last little bit of the run here?
Yeah. So well, I had, you know, after the content, then it was from a design perspective. So then design takes all my notes on like header one, header two, make this table, right? Make this bolded list. And then I had to go through, and it's so funny because when I worked in the hospital, I worked with our tech team. And again, just like when people are speaking almost like two different languages, like when you tell them one thing and then you get it back and you're like, oh wait, I can see how this was, they didn't understand what I meant. I felt it was like the same thing. I was like, oh wait. And so there was just lots of like little design things like indent this. And so, you know, make this table like this, although they actually got it way more close to what I wanted it to be than I thought at the first pass, which I was really impressed by. So that was one step. And then we had already done the cover design and like gone back and forth with that, you know, earlier on, but then it was kind of the jacket, like the back and the, you know, jacket flaps and the content in those, which was, that was fairly straightforward. And then, yeah, you know, that was all a couple months ago. And then I literally, the time we're recording this, I got my copy like 3 days ago. So I actually like can like hold it now and see it. So it's real.
It's real.
Which, yeah, after like all these little things, and I've been staring at it in PDF form now for months. And like I printed it out in PDF form, like when I was going through with edits. And yeah, it feels very surreal to now be like holding it in a book form.
As I say, that's got to be an amazing feeling to just to have the real thing now. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the last step. You and I are in the same group with Kelly. I came across you asked like, hey, I'm looking to promo this book. podcast interviews. And I was like, as long as you want to spin it to kind of talking about the business side of it, which you were all for, and I think it's still a great book to talk about. What has been kind of your responsibility when it comes to the PR for this book?
That is such a good question. So this is something that, you know, everybody I know that's written a book told me this ahead of time, because again, unless you're like a Brené Brown or like an Oprah, you know, well, technically I do have a PR team, like a two people, like a marketing person and PR person in a publishing house who work with me. It's really mostly up to me. They have been helpful. Like I jumped on calls with a marketing person probably like 6 months ago, just to sort of start going through like the processes, and they have a massive Google Doc just with all these suggestions of different things to do. But yeah, you know, from a PR marketing's perspective, especially after the launch, you know, they are helping like pitch me to other podcasts and pitch me to media right now. But yeah, I think like once it launches, from what I've heard, like you're kind of then on your own. And the first, this is something I'm working with Kelly on, because like the first year of a book is really like where you kind of make or break. Like, is this book going to be something that gets in people's hands, that people get read? So yeah, having to really come up with my own strategy. And podcasts is, you know, Kelly said to me a couple months ago, she was like, if you do one thing, if you put all your eggs in one basket, like podcast basket. So that's kind of the primary thing that I've been the last couple of months, just, you know, reaching out to everybody that I know with a podcast or a podcast that I listen to talk about the book. The other things is, so I'm right now at the time we are speaking, I'm in the midst of a 2-week series where I'm doing live interviews on Instagram with other people from my community. And just to kind of, again, like, I mean, it's been fun for me to speak to people, and I'm usually not on that side of the interview booth. So it's been interesting to speak to people, but just really, yeah, asking them what being unapologetic means to them, and like what impact it's had on their life to get free from these, you know, systems of oppression and diet culture in particular. And so really just using that to kind of spread the word. I'm having a book launch party on the 9th, which is, it's free, optional donation to a nonprofit. Again, just trying to ask everybody I know to share. I think that's something that I'm leaning into more, is just asking for help, you know, in getting this book out. And yeah, I think I have some plans for the rest of the year that include, I'm probably going to do some type of group program using the book framework, because that is the framework that I go through with my clients. So I'm probably going to do that at least a couple of times. I have some like free webinar ideas. And then I think I am starting a podcast, which has been on my list, and Kelly moved it up my list. She was like, no, this is this spring. Like, you got to do it this spring. So that's probably like one of the next things that's going to be coming. Yeah.
Very awesome. This is all so very exciting. If there was one piece of advice that you had known sooner in this process, what would it be? All the aspiring writers out there, what's the one thing you wish you'd heard sooner?
That's such a good question. So the first thing that comes to mind, I think, is not having to know it all and not having to have it be perfect. This was something I actually read in another book, you know, while I was in the process of writing my book, about, and I included a, you know, something similar in my book of just, okay, this book is like where I am at a point in time, and I am always learning, always growing, always unlearning, and like relearning different things, and just acknowledging like, okay, you know, because there's part of me that just kept feeling like, oh, well, then there's this and I got to get this in there. And then, oh, what about this? And oh, and just like, no, like this is a point in time. At some point, you just have to be like, okay, here's what I know now. You know, what's going to be the best for my reader of this book? And just not worrying about that, you know, kind of trying to let go of that perfectionist thinking and just, you know, doing the best that I can in that moment. And then I'm sure, yes, when it comes out, there's already going to be things that are like, ooh, yeah, I could have done that differently. And that's fine. And then that's for the next book.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that. Cause and on such a big project, both number of words and span of time that you're working on this, like you said, the new information, the change of nuance, like, if you try to stay current, it will never get published.
So somewhere you just, like you said, I love that, putting it in the frame of reference of like one moment in time. Like this is, there's, we're going to put the pin here. We're going to write from this point. And then there's always, you know, addition to and or the next book to take it the next step when we get there. I love it. Yeah. Well, thank you, Elisa. This has been delightful. Unapologetic Eating, Make Peace with Food and Transform Your Life, out today, all your major book places.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Tell us where else we can find you so people can learn more about you in the book.
Sure. So my website is alyssarumsey.com. And then Instagram is also where I am very active. And that is at alyssarumseyrd.
Awesome. And I will make sure all of that is in the show notes. So it's super easy to find. Thank you. This has been delightful.
Yeah.
And congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much again for having me.
Thanks for tuning in for another week of Steady She Grows. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to screenshot the show and give a share over on Instagram. Tag me at casey.jordan and share your key takeaways. You can also rate and review the show on Apple Podcast or wherever you give it a listen. And until next week, my friends, keep on crushing it.